So we're going to keep an eye on the Sean Parnell allegations. Another beauty of an endorsement from Donald Trump. These are just allegations for the time being. Just important to mention that. There's a reason why in this story's YouTube clip, I'm using the word accidentally in quotes, because when it comes to accidentally firing a gun, we really shouldn't be using the word accidental. We should be using the word negligent. We should be using the word reckless. The headline, as it's being reported by WLOX and others, is that a woman had a gun in her purse during a basketball game. And she accidentally fired the gun. I don't think accidentally is really the right word that we should be using here. But the story is a woman has been given a $500 bond after firing a gun at a basketball game in Madison, Madison, Mississippi, that is. According to police, the incident happened inside the gym at Rosa Scott School Monday night. During the game, Kashawn Alexis McReynolds reached into her purse to grab her phone, but accidentally fired her gun. Nobody was hurt, but the game was suspended while investigators escorted McReynolds to a secure office inside the school. McReynolds did have an enhanced concealed carry permit, or permit, as some folks like to say, which allowed her to have the firearm at the event. However, she was charged with discharging a firearm within the city limits of Madison in violation of the City of Madison ordinance. McReynolds was given a $500 bond and a court date to appear before Madison Municipal Court. Accidentally means negligent discharge. We have to stop normalizing these incidents by calling them accidents. And that's why I'm calling this, quote, accidentally. It's the wrong word. It was a negligent discharge that was related to the reckless handling of a firearm. Imagine, now it didn't happen here, but it happens all the time. Imagine ending someone's life with such a dumb mistake. It's happened. We've covered the stories. Even, I mean, this is now kind of a whole other topic in a sense, because some people pointing out this was a legal concealed carry individual, licensed. Even the classes that are run in many states are kind of a joke. As I've said before, I don't talk about whether I own guns, so I'm just going to couch this generally. There are many liberals I know that own guns who have said the classes really can be passed by morons. And we know that to be true because of the number of instances where it's not a someone who criminally obtained a gun, doesn't have a permit, doesn't have a concealed carry permit, whatever. People who are licensed and up to date on everything that they're supposed to do, who behave recklessly and negligently with firearms. And if and until, and I'm like a broken record on this, if and until accidents are actually treated like the serious negligence that they are, I don't think we're going to see anything change. The Madison Cawthorn incident is just a perfect example of this, where Republican Congressman Madison Cawthorn tried to board a plane from, I think it was somewhere to Charlotte, maybe it was Asheville to Charlotte or something like that. And he tried, in the sense that he had a firearm in his carry-on, he tried to board a plane to get through TSA security with a firearm. And it was chalked to, oh, it was an accident. He didn't know the gun was in the bag, as if that's an excuse. If you don't know where your firearm is, if you believe the firearm that you're responsible for, which is a huge responsibility, if you believe that firearm is in one place and it's actually in a different place, that's reckless. That's negligent. It's not an excuse to say, I didn't think it was in my bag. That's an indication that we should be reviewing whether you should even be allowed to have that gun at all. So we're going to, you know, it's an issue we're going to continue covering. And the extent to which this is something Democrats should be running on, I've said before, I don't know that it's pragmatically speaking a good issue to win elections, particularly in places where it's very purple to reddish. But it's an issue that's not going away anytime soon. Here is an interesting voicemail about vaccination incentives. We talk about carrot versus stick. If you want to call me, you can call 219-2-DAVID-P any time of day. A few hints for voicemails. Number one, don't leave me 3, 5, 7, 12 voicemails in a row. If you do that, they almost certainly are not going to be played. That's one bit of advice. Second bit of advice, do not leave voicemails that are the full 3 minutes long. We have never played a 3-minute voicemail on the show. That's the maximum that is allowed on our voicemail system. Voicemails tend to be between 30 and 90 seconds. And number three, get to your point quickly. And this voicemail does all of these things. It's 32 seconds long. We can hear the caller clearly, and he gets right to his point. And the question is, why are people getting rewarded for not getting vaccinated, in the sense that the longer you wait, the more likely it is you'll be offered $100 or free sports tickets or whatever the case may be? Take a listen.
David, seriously, why are people getting rewarded for not taking the vaccine? Why are states giving people who haven't taken the vaccine money?
Right.
From New York and Glasgow, this is Democracy Now!
If we cannot have an understanding, a legally binding agreement, where countries agree not to push global temperatures above 1.5 degrees. If we cannot do that, we will die as a community, as a nation.
As carbon emissions rise worldwide, we speak to the former president of one of the most vulnerable island nations, Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives. Less than 6 months after he survived an assassination attempt outside his home, he will join us from Glasgow. We'll also speak to the prominent British climate lawyer Farhana Yamin, who helped negotiate the Paris Climate Accord and was later arrested for gluing both of her hands to the ground outside Shell's London headquarters as part of an Extinction Rebellion action. Plus, we look at the fight in Glasgow over how much the United States and other wealthy nations should help poorer nations cut emissions and adapt to the devastating effects of the climate crisis.
There are some rich nations and rich corporations who are holding the power, and they do not want developing countries to have access to justice, which could be in the form of vaccines or the climate action that we have been demanding for decades now.
We'll speak to Harjeet Singh of the Climate Action Network, who's pushing for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New data shows global carbon emissions have returned to near record levels after a short dip due to the COVID pandemic. Emissions from coal, gas, and oil all rose over the past year. The findings by the Global Carbon Project came as a critical United Nations climate summit known as COP26 continues in Glasgow, Scotland. On Tuesday, the president of the Pacific Island state of Palau, Sir Angell Whipps Jr., warned without immediate and dramatic action to curb greenhouse gas emissions, his nation will be swallowed by rising seas.
Frankly speaking, there is no dignity to a slow and painful death. You might as well bomb our islands instead of making us suffer only to witness our slow and fateful demise. Leaders of the G20, we are drowning, and our only hope is the life ring you are holding.
On Wednesday, indigenous leaders from across the world marched on COP26, demanding the protection of their lands and indigenous-led solutions to the climate emergency. Police arrested at least five people as hundreds of Extinction Rebellion members held a protest against corporate greenwashing at the COP. After headlines, we'll go to the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow for the rest of the hour. New Jersey Democratic Governor Phil Murphy has won a second term after surviving a surprisingly close re-election bid against Republican Jack Chitarelli. Murphy had been heavily favored in New Jersey, which has about a million more registered Democrats than Republicans. It was the latest indication Democrats could lose ground during critical midterm elections next year. On Wednesday, President Biden said he hoped to reverse the Democratic Party's fortunes by passing his 10-year, $1.75 trillion green energy and social safety net bill.
People are upset and uncertain about a lot of things, from COVID to school to jobs to a whole range of things and the cost of a gallon of gasoline. And so if I'm able to pass, sign into law, my Build Back Better initiative, I'm in a position where you're going to see a lot of those things ameliorated quickly and swiftly.
In Buffalo, New York, Democratic Socialist mayoral candidate India Walton has conceded to incumbent Mayor Byron Brown, who ran a successful write-in campaign after losing the Democratic primary to Walton. In Minneapolis, Mayor Jacob Frey has won re-election. Frey opposed a ballot measure to replace the Minneapolis police with the Department of Public Safety. That measure failed to pass. In Detroit, voters passed ballot initiatives to form a reparations task force and to decriminalize some psychedelic drugs, including magic mushrooms. Similar drug ballot initiatives passed in Oregon and Washington, D.C. last year. On Wednesday's broadcast, we mistakenly said those votes took place on Tuesday. Meanwhile, in Tucson, Arizona, voters have approved a citywide $15 an hour minimum wage by a 2-to-1 margin. For the second time, Republicans in the United States Senate have used the filibuster to block a bill to restore parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act gutted by the Supreme Court 8 years ago. On Wednesday, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski was the sole Republican to join 49 members of the Democratic caucus voting in favor of opening debate on the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. The 50-49 majority was not enough to overcome the 60 votes needed to break a Republican filibuster. United States recorded nearly 1,900 COVID-19 deaths Wednesday, pushing the official U.S. death toll from the pandemic past 750,000. That's 750,000 confirmed coronavirus deaths, more than any other country on Earth. And researchers at the University of Washington estimate the true U.S. death toll is even higher at over 860,000. The White House urged parents to get their young children vaccinated as the first child-sized doses of Pfizer shots were administered around the country. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy warned against the spread of misinformation about kids and vaccines.
Many parents are already seeing inaccurate claims on social media, text threads, and in their inboxes. Now, I believe every parent has a right to the facts so they can make decisions for their children based on accurate scientific information. Misinformation robs them of this freedom.
Russia continues to battle a worsening coronavirus wave, setting a new daily record Thursday with nearly 1,200 deaths. Russia is in the middle of what authorities are calling a non-working week in an attempt to keep people home and curb infections. Cases are also surging across much of Europe. In the Netherlands, Prime Minister Mark Rutte has introduced face mask requirements for public spaces and will expand the Corona Pass program, requiring proof of vaccination for museums, gyms, outdoor terraces, and other public spaces. The World Health Organization's granted emergency use authorization to India's COVID-19 vaccine known as Covaxin. The two-dose vaccine is based on an inactivated form of the coronavirus. It's easily stored and showed 78% efficacy against symptomatic disease in a clinical trial. It's the 8th COVID-19 vaccine approved by the WHO. The U.S. has added the Israeli firm NSO Group to a trade blacklist following reports its Pegasus spyware was used by governments to target activists, journalists, and government officials. NSO's spyware has been used on phones belonging to family members of assassinated Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi and reporters and dissidents from the United Arab Emirates and Mexico, among other places. You can see our full coverage of the issue at democracynow.org. Hundreds of protesters marched through the streets of Mexico City Wednesday, carrying crosses bearing the names of murdered women, demanding strong government action to end femicide. Mexico's government reported at least 762 women were murdered between January and September this year. But a recent report by Amnesty International found the true toll is likely much higher, with more than 10 women and girls killed daily across Mexico. Meanwhile, trans women held a ceremony in Mexico City Tuesday, marking Mexico's national holiday, the Day of the Dead. This is trans activist Kenya Cuevas.
Historically, transgender women have been invisibilized. Our families exclude us. In the Mexican altars of our families, there will never be a picture of us. That is why it is crucial to place this altar to vindicate the trans women who have died.
Mexico has the second highest rate of reported murders of trans people after Brazil and just ahead of the United States. In immigration news, President Biden responded to reports his administration is considering compensation of up to $450,000 per family separated at the U.S.-Mexico border under Trump's zero-tolerance policy.
$450,000 per person. Is that what you're saying?
That was separated from a family member at the border under the last administration.
That's not going to happen.
Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, which is representing the affected families, said Biden's refusal to remedy the trauma and other psychological harm caused by family separation would be an abandonment of a core campaign promise. A new report from the Transnational Institute finds some of the world's most polluting countries have spent over twice as much on border enforcement than on combating the climate emergency. The worst offenders are Canada, the U.S., Australia, and the U.K. Additionally, the world's largest fossil fuel companies are employing the same companies that receive government contracts to militarize their borders. Activist Kumi Naidu responded, quote, "It's unacceptable that rich countries are building a climate wall and spending more on arming their borders than on tackling the root causes that drive climate-linked displacement." To see our interview with Kumi Naidu, go to democracynow.org. In Georgia, the judge overseeing the murder trial of three white men who hunted down and killed black jogger Ahmaud Arbery last year found intentional discrimination in the jury selection after a single black juror was chosen. The 11 other jurors are white. The judge nonetheless is allowing the trial to go ahead with opening statements expected Friday. And in labor news, New York City taxi drivers are celebrating a major victory after New York agreed to restructure medallion loans, which could eliminate millions of dollars in devastating debt. Under the agreement, individual debts will be maxed out at $170,000, down from an average of about $500,000. The city will also give the main lender a cash payment for each indebted driver and guarantee every loan. Taxi drivers had been on hunger strike for 2 weeks before the deal was announced. This is Bhairavi Desai of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance speaking Wednesday.
This is a historic moment. These terms mean that over 4,000 to 6,000 families can get their life back. Yeah. These terms mean that our brothers and sisters will no longer have a lifetime of debt.
You can see our recent interview with Bhairavi Desai and with two people who joined the hunger strike at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We go now to the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, as new data shows global carbon emissions have returned to near record levels after a short dip due to the COVID pandemic. Emissions from coal, gas, and oil all rose over the past year. We turn now to one of the world's leading climate advocates, Mohamed Nasheed, the former president of the low-lying island nation of the Maldives, which is located in the Indian Ocean. In 2008, he became the first democratically elected leader of the Maldives. He once held a cabinet meeting underwater to highlight the threat of global warming and pledged to make the Maldives the first carbon-neutral country, installed solar panels on the roof of his presidential residence. Mohamed Nasheed's story was told in the 2012 documentary, The Island President.
If we can't stop the seas rising, if you allow for a 2-degree rise in temperature, you are actually agreeing to kill us.
While President Nasheed is recognized as a global climate champion abroad, at home, his political fortunes have taken many turns. In 2012, he was overthrown in a coup. He was later imprisoned. But his political career didn't end. After time in jail and exile, he returned to the Maldives, where he now serves as Speaker of the Parliament. In May, he survived an assassination attempt when his home was bombed. He was left critically injured, needed 16 hours of surgery. Police arrested several militants linked to the Islamic State for the attack. President Mohamed Nasheed joins us now in Glasgow, where he is taking part in the UN Climate Summit. Again, Speaker of the Parliament of the Maldives. Welcome back to Democracy Now! First, I want to ask, since we haven't spoken since the assassination attempt, how are you feeling? And talk about why you are now back in Glasgow at the UN Climate Summit.
Thank you. I mean, thank you very much for having me. I am much better. I have spent over 5 months getting better. I'm not on any medication. I can now do my exercises. I can run. But of course, my left side is very scarred. There's a lot of wounds or scars and numbness on my fingers. But I can get around and I can do my thing. Thank you very much, and it's lovely to be on your show again.
It's great to have you with us. If you can talk about then why you are in Glasgow, what you want to see from this UN Climate Summit. You've been to a number of them. What makes this one different?
I now work as the ambassador for the Climate Vulnerable Forum. This is a forum of 48 countries. Currently, Prime Minister Hasina of Bangladesh chairs the forum. We have four specific asks from the COP26. One is to see that global temperatures do not rise above 1.5 degrees. We now live on a planet that has already heated 1.2 degrees. And you can now see that the winds are stronger, the waves are higher, the summers are longer, there's more rain, the coral reef is bleaching, we are losing our biodiversity, there's rampant coastal erosion, and our water is contaminated. We are spending more than 30% of our budget on adaptation measures. We are challenged from all sides, and we come to COP to ask countries to maintain 1.5 degrees. That's very important. We also want to remind countries that in 2009, they pledged developing countries and climate vulnerable countries to pay $100 billion a year, but that hasn't realized, and we want to see that contribution again on track. We also like to see countries submit their nationally determined contributions, NDCs, every year instead of every 5 years. That is what countries think how much they would emit carbon in the next year. So we would like to see countries do that every year. The climate vulnerable countries are also very debt ridden. Most of our countries pay 20% of our budget for debt repayment. We would like to see a debt swap to climate resilient projects and restructure our debt. So, you know, we have these kind of very focused four things that we are asking. And I am hopeful that these issues would figure in the outcome of COP26, in the decisions that the countries make at the end of this conference.
President Nasheed, what responsibility do you think developing countries that are now among the biggest emitters, some of them, have with respect to cutting emissions? You've said the argument of historical emissions cannot be used as an excuse for developing countries to keep polluting. You said, quote, it's like saying that the West has brought us to the brink and the new big emitting countries have a right to push us off the cliff. President Nasheed.
Well, that certainly is the case. But that is no reason why historical big emitters, countries that have emitted carbon for the last 500 years and has found a very prosperous living because of that, should not help other countries who are in need. Now, for instance, let's say India's ambition. Recently, they have come out and they have suggested that they would make 50% of their energy from renewable sources in 20 years. That's a huge ambition. And I think developed countries must understand and see these gestures and these efforts of other countries and play a bigger role in it. Yes, none of these people should be emitting carbon and poisoning the atmosphere. They must find new development strategies, and these strategies are available. So the developed countries must contribute to the developing countries in both mitigation and adaptation.
And President Nasheed, do you think it's significant that Russia and China have not sent representatives to the COP? Has that does that have a huge effect? And do you think it says anything about their commitments with respect to reducing emissions?
Well, it is very, very sad that China and Russia is not here. And it is, again, also very worrying if countries think that they can use the UNFCCC or the climate negotiations in as strategic leverage on their other disagreements and differences. I would like countries to set climate differences to be climate differences and not to mix them with their other strategic differences. China must come. Russia must come to the table. They cannot not come here and maintain business as usual. That has a very big impact on other countries. It is very worrying that they are not here. I hope that they will still send their good envoys and that they would make a contribution that would maintain global temperatures below 1.5 degrees. Russia and China must do that.
I want to go back to October 2009, over a decade ago, when you held that cabinet meeting underwater when you were president to bring attention to the dire consequences of climate change. You and 11 government ministers wore scuba gear, plunged nearly 20 feet into the Indian Ocean.
We are actually trying to send our message, let the world know what is happening and what will happen to the Maldives if climate change is not checked. This is a challenging situation, and we want to see that everyone else is also occupied as much as we are, and would like to see that people actually do something about it.
Wouldn't this be amazing if this were the image that we saw of the world leaders like the Prime Minister of India, the President of Brazil, Russia, China, the President of the United States, all in scuba gear having a meeting. But since that time, President Nasheed, you have been tortured, you've been detained, you've been imprisoned, and now there was an attempt to assassinate you. Is this latest attempt, do you think, because of your climate activism? Have they captured the people who are involved with it?
They have. The Prosecutor General has charged 12 people. And the police think that these people are linked to extremist ideology. But they have not found who paid for it and who schemed it. Unless a proper investigation is done and these perpetrators are found, it is very worrying and difficult for me to live a normal life. Now, who tried to murder me? Why did they try to murder me? That would, I think, depend on a bigger and a more in-depth investigation and when that is done. We still haven't got there. I will continue my work. I cannot stop it, and I will not stop it. I refuse to relent. We have won against the odds before, and I want to win against the odds even now. We came to this COP with global temperatures projected to rise to 2.9 degrees. given the submissions that countries had done before they came to the COP. But now with the new submissions from India and the understanding on methane and the forest agreement, it is looking like that temperatures can be around 1.7 degrees, 1.9 degrees. So I feel that 1.5 is doable, and we have to advocate for it and work for it. We will not stop.
President Nasheed, could you say in 2009, you held that meeting underwater, which received a lot of attention. What has happened since then, and what would have happened? What would you have liked to see happen at all of the negotiations that have happened since in the last 12 years?
Well, sea level has been rising 4 millimeters a year in the Maldives. Our water is now contaminated, and we have to desalinate water, and that is very, very expensive. We would like to see countries clearly agreeing to 1.5 degrees. The coral reef is bleached, and therefore we are losing its biodiversity. When we lose that, there is more coastal erosion. And when the weather is bad all the time, it's very difficult to travel from one island to the other as well. Our livelihood is disrupted. And we want to see countries agree that this is an emergency. And we want to see countries do things that they do in an emergency. When the COVID pandemic came and when countries decided that it was an emergency, they found a vaccine for it within a year. And it took 70 years to find a vaccine for malaria. This probably is because malaria is more rampant in Africa and Asia. Richer countries who have the science and who have the knowledge and money don't have these diseases. And once the minute that it has an impact on them, there are solutions. Now, with the climate, I suspect the same thing would happen. But it's very sad. You know, there's 200 people died in Germany of flash floods, the same in Belgium. Poland is burning, Greece is burning, Serbia is burning, there is fires in tundra, there's water everywhere, there's high winds everywhere. The planet is losing its balance. We must understand this and we must get a grip on the situation. You can't be burying your head under the sand thinking that it is not happening. It is happening, and it is happening now. And it is happening to you.
Finally, President Nasheed, as you head back from Glasgow to the Maldives, have you ever considered simply not heading back? I mean, you almost lost your life several times there. The danger is so incredibly high. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about endangered environmental activists around the world. Why do you return? And what message do you have for the world leaders, particularly President Biden, who's just left there?
Well, I have a job to do, and I have a purpose in my life. There must be a reason why I survived, and God has a purpose. This is God's creation. We are all here by the grace of God, and you can't destroy it. You can't destroy the planet, neither should you be killing other people. I will go back. I can't. I do not want to live elsewhere. I like my country, and I want to live in the Maldives. A fish can't survive out of water. And I know it's tough, and I know it's dangerous, and I know it's difficult. But I want to live there, and I want to continue doing what I do, which is advocate for climate change action, advocate for human rights, advocate for democracy, to see that our people have a better living, to see that our rights are defended. I will go back.
Mohamed Nasheed, former president of the Maldives and climate justice champion, recently survived and recovered from an assassination attempt in May. He's now Speaker of the Parliament of the Maldives. And as he talks to us from Glasgow, there is a large, slowly rotating globe that is suspended over the UN Climate Hall. Coming up, we speak to the prominent British climate lawyer, Farhana Yamin, who helped negotiate the Paris Climate Accord, was later arrested for gluing both her hands to the ground outside Shell's London headquarters as part of an Extinction Rebellion protest. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. That's fake blood, Ife. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As closed-door negotiations continue at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, climate justice activists are taking to the streets outside the COP, demanding the United States and other large polluters agree to drastic cuts in carbon emissions to save the world from a climate catastrophe. On Wednesday, police arrested at least five people as hundreds of Extinction Rebellion members held a protest against corporate greenwashing at the COP. We turn now to one of the most prominent climate lawyers in Britain, who's been deeply involved in international climate negotiations for decades, but is also engaged in direct action to effect change. Farhana Yamin is in Glasgow, where she's working with the Climate Vulnerable Forum, a group that represents 48 of the countries most threatened by the climate crisis. We last spoke with her in 2019 after she was arrested for supergluing her hands to the ground outside Shell's headquarters in London as part of an Extinction Rebellion action.
Stop lobbying government to delay action. These prove to me that the legal process is pretty broken right now. And we're having to break law rather than make law because of the inaction of 30 years now of these companies.
That was Farhana Yamin in 2019. She's joining us now in front of the rotating globe suspended over the UN Climate Assembly in Glasgow, Scotland. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Farhana. It's great to have you with us as we watched you in that action. Talk about what it means to be out on the streets, super gluing yourself, protesting the fossil fuel giant Shell, and then being inside. You're passing, I assume, many of those same fossil fuel lobbyists, but your two-pronged approach, inside and outside, as you help to negotiate the Paris Climate Agreement.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me back. I really salute all those who are taking the actions in the streets and demanding real accountability, demanding climate justice. Climate justice, you know, my nerdy legal self, is actually in the Paris Agreement. It's a paragraph here in the preamble. We're trying to make good on that preamble or paragraph, and we're trying to hold, you know, corporations and countries to account. The net zero emissions goal, which was a very important goal, is not just greenwash. It has to be made good. It has to have emissions that are real, and those emissions cannot be bought at the expense of vulnerable people and countries, in effect displacing emissions, and they must have strong accountability for their actions, which must result in actual changes, not just, as I said, greenwashing and buying offsets from others.
Farhana, as we mentioned, Extinction Rebellion members have been protesting against corporate greenwashing at the COP. Could you explain what historically the role of corporations has been in these climate conferences, and the fact that some of the largest oil, gas and coal producers have yet to outline how they intend to decrease fossil fuel use?
Well, the role historically of the large oil and gas companies has been to lobby countries to delay action, to stop the science being acted on. And that's what's happened for 30 years. And the frustration that I had, you know, back in 2019 was to see how well organized, how well funded, how well orchestrated that lobbying, marketing, behind-the-scenes manipulation was that has resulted in the delays here. So I'm very happy that groups like Extinction Rebellion and many others are now outing these companies, and we are learning more and more through investigative journalism of the role that has been played in stymieing action by these companies. So I really welcome, you know, a torch being shone on their very clever orchestration. And it's time also that, you know, advertising companies, the Edelmans of the world, the PR, marketing and other professions that are aiding and abetting this obstruction, it's time that they realize that those delays that have resulted have also resulted from their own actions. You know, you cannot now accept clients who are basically putting the earth in peril as clients and still say that you support sustainability.
Well, in August, the IPCC report was quite staggering in its warnings about what the world will face if extremely swift and large-scale actions are not needed. The UN Secretary General called this a code red, called the report code red for humanity. You've attended 23 of the 25 COPs. What have you seen change as the urgency of the situation has so manifestly grown?
Yeah, it's 24 out of 26. But what's changed for me is actually a huge amount of energy, a huge appetite for change and a demand for action coming from our young people, from our indigenous people, from women, from our trade union, from workers from around the world. And that is being stymied, is being stopped, and is not coming into the energy that's needed in this room. I stress the word energy because today's energy day, and the energy that we need is political energy, because it's really the politicians who are behind the science. The politicians are listening and in the pockets sometimes of the vested interests that I spoke about, from the fossil fuel industry to large agribusiness. And I think that that's what has shifted here, is that realization that we have to act together. And these corporations, those who are most powerful, especially the G20 countries, they have to act, and they cannot hide behind any more excuses.
Farhana Yamin, in 2015, you helped negotiate that landmark Paris Agreement. President Biden, when he was at COP this week, apologized for the previous president, Trump, pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. What message do you have now for the U.S. Congress, where you see this major division within the Democratic Party, let alone the Republicans, around the issue of a Green New Deal and providing enough money to transition the U.S. off of fossil fuels? What message do you have for them right now among those Senator Manchin, who is the largest oil, gas and coal recipient of campaign funds in the U.S. Congress, who has almost single-handedly stopped the climate accord in Congress from moving forward?
Well, we can only appeal to all of those in Congress, including the senator who must listen to his conscience, must not only put his constituents' short-term interests, but listen very much to the hearts and pleas of all of those who are gathered here and help the U.S. retain its credibility. We know that the U.S. wants to do the right thing, but we would like the U.S. government to be more joined up here and to deliver on the financial pledges and to deliver on action at home. And the U.S. is an incredible leader, and it needs to regain the trust and work as an ally with others. So I appeal to his constituents directly to please, lobby him instead of him being lobbied by the fossil fuel industries and receiving this money. I would urge all of those citizens in the rest of the U.S. to pile in and put the pressure on, because it really matters. The U.S. really matters, and its delivery on its promises, its pledges really matter here.
And Farhana Yameen, finally, before we conclude, talk about the work that you're doing with the Climate Vulnerable Forum. We were just speaking to former Maldives president Nasheed, and the Maldives was of course one of the founding members. Could you explain the work that you're doing with this group?
Well, we've been working to get the whole of this conference to adopt a climate emergency pact framing that delivers on an annual, year-by-year ambition cycle instead of the five-year cycle that we had in Paris, to deliver on the $500 billion, which is the total sum, if you add up what was owed from 2020 to 2024. We want the money to go to adaptation, which is basically a Cinderella still, and for the money to go 50-50 to mitigation and adaptation. And lastly, to also fund and recognize the harm that's already happening. And again, to fulfill the promise of Article 8 here on loss and damage. So the Earth is, requiring us to repair the harm done, and we would like this conference to acknowledge that harm is happening and to fund and support the pillars of the Paris Agreement that are about loss and damage.
Farhana Yameen, we want to thank you for being with us, international environmental lawyer who helped write the landmark 2015 Paris Agreement. Next up, we remain in Glasgow and speak with Harjeet Singh of the Climate Action Network, who's helping to lead a campaign for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. Stay with us.
You on. We have been reborn to build, we must destroy.
Message in a Hammer by Orbang JR. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we continue our climate countdown. We are here for 2 weeks, Glasgow and New York, bringing you comprehensive coverage inside the COP, outside on the streets, and around the world for people who couldn't make it to the UN Climate Summit, but are active in their own communities. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As we continue our coverage of negotiations at COP26 and the push to address the growing climate crisis by reducing greenhouse gas emissions and funding the transition to renewable energy. Critics note the Paris Agreement, the legally binding international treaty from the 2015 UN Climate Summit, does not mention the words coal, oil, or gas once. Momentum's now building for a complementary international mechanism to manage a global just transition. This is a video produced by the campaign to establish a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty.
The generation that grew up with nuclear weapons were told to hide under their desks in case of attack. This generation faces an even greater threat, the climate crisis. And again, they have nowhere to hide. While citizens, cities, and countries are working to reduce their emissions, behind our backs, the coal, oil, and gas industry continues to rapidly expand fossil fuels, driving catastrophic warming. Surviving the climate crisis requires a bold new idea. Introducing the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. Why a treaty? 50 years ago, the world signed a non-proliferation treaty to avoid nuclear war. In 1987, the Montreal Protocol protected the ozone. The Paris Agreement begins to limit emissions, but doesn't mention coal, oil, or gas. We need a global plan to end the proliferation of fossil fuels and fast-track solutions. A fossil fuel treaty would phase out coal, oil, and gas faster, more fairly, and forever, while supporting workers, communities, and countries dependent on fossil fuels.
This comes as securing money for poor nations to help cut emissions and adapt to the effects of climate change, so-called loss and damage, is a key focus at COP26. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi co-chaired an event this week to launch a fund to help small island developing states build infrastructure to cope with rising sea levels. This is Modi speaking in Glasgow.
Excellencies, infrastructure.
Excellencies, the infrastructure for resilient island states launch gives a new hope, a new trust, a new chance for vulnerable countries to do something.
India is the world's third biggest emitter of greenhouse gases after China and the United States. For more, we're joined from inside COP26 in Glasgow, Scotland, by Harjeet Singh, senior advisor with Climate Action Network and with the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, based in New Delhi, India, usually, but in Glasgow now. Welcome back, Harjeet, to Democracy Now! The fossil fuel, if you can talk more about the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, what has to be done to prevent the climate emergency from devastating the world even further?
Amy, this is a huge challenge here that we are talking about cutting emissions and mitigation, but we are not putting enough focus on fossil fuel. We are not even mentioning fossil fuel in our discussions. How can you not talk about the elephant in the room, you know, one that has caused the crisis? And the whole negotiations are just avoiding the term coal, oil, and gas. It's there on the outside, but not in Paris Agreement. And unless you target fossil fuel industry that continues to enjoy the taxpayers' money as subsidies to the tune of $11 million a minute, you cannot deal with climate crisis. So we have to target fossil fuel industry head on. And that's exactly what this treaty idea does. We want a treaty that is complementary to Paris Agreement, because Paris Agreement has talked about what, but very little about how. And this treaty talks about ending fossil fuel expansion, phasing out, and also just transition, which is important because many developing countries are stuck with fossil fuel. Their economy depends on that. Their workers depend on fossil fuel industry. And how do we phase that out in a manner that also promote social and economic justice. And that's how the pillar that we have in this treaty initiative on just transition is an extremely important aspect, particularly for developing countries, but also for the developed world.
Well, one of the things, Harjeet, that the 2015 Paris Accord called for was net zero emissions by 2050. Can you explain what exactly that means and what would be required to do that? What countries have pledged to do that?
Well, we call it carbon neutral, or now this fancy term of net zero technically means that the amount of emissions we are putting into the atmosphere are then either removed or balanced by the sinks, you know, through forest, oceans. And of course, there's a lot of emphasis on technology so that the net emissions are zero. And while technically it is a correct term, but how many rich companies and countries have started using it to delay action, because they are talking about a net zero target of 2050 without any near-term goals on how emissions are going to be reduced or how they are going to move away from fossil fuel. And if we only look at the 2050 targets, and many countries have pledged, and UK government is making this as a headline thing, that if countries commit to net zero, COP26 is a success. It cannot be a success unless we look at near-term targets, because science tells us that we have to halve the emissions by 2030. Just in 9 years, where is that plan? And we don't see that plan being discussed, except a handful of countries who are talking about near-term targets. And that's not going to, you know, make us meet the target of Paris Agreement of staying below 1.5 degree. So it is really concerning to put so much of emphasis on net zero with such longer-term time plan and not looking at near-term targets.
Well, you've also said, Harjeet, just to go to other big polluting countries now, you've said in another interview that there's a lot of pressure on India to commit to a net zero target without recognizing that comparing India and China is not fair. And if India were to commit, if it agrees to a net zero goal by a particular year, it will only be an imaginary exercise and not based on empirical studies and analysis on how it can be achieved. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, that's exactly, Naomi, the problem with net zero. You just push for a number. Yes, science has told us that we need to be carbon neutral by 2050. But when it comes to allocating targets, and that's where the discussion of carbon budget becomes really important, you cannot expect all countries to become net zero or carbon neutral by 2050. Yes, if you want the common finish line, you also have to go back and look at the start line. Rich countries have been polluting for more than 100 years. For 50 years, they knew that climate change is going to be a problem. And whereas if we talk about a country like India, where industrialization began only in late 90s, you want India to have a common finish line without recognizing that 100 million people still do not have access to electricity, without realizing that a quarter of population is still poor. And comparing with China is absolutely not fair, because China's emissions and economy are 4 to 5 times of India's. So you have to understand, if India comes up with a target, it will need more time unless you provide sufficient resources. And for India, which was until the last moment was not agreeing to a net zero target, had to accede to the pressure, because the whole negotiations over these 2 weeks would have become very difficult for India. India would have, you know, just become a punching bag. So what they have done, they've released the pressure. They have come up with a date. You know, rich countries are saying 2050. China says 2060. India says 2070. There are no empirical studies that have been done. You know, the states have not been consulted. But I would not blame government for this particular action, because, you know, coming to this space where there is so much of pressure, just on net zero, they had to put a finger on a particular year, and they chose 2070.
So you operate inside and outside the COP. I mean, at home in India, on the streets in Glasgow now, and here you are sitting inside. I wanted to ask you about the comments of researcher at Transnational Institute, Brid Brennan, who said COP26 has become a big bonanza for the corporate financiers and polluters, derailing a historic opportunity to achieve CO2 emissions and disinvestment from fossil fuels, while global popular demand to governments has urged a decisive pullback from the brink of climate change disaster. Corporate financiers and polluters have pursued a strategy of privatization of the UN system and are now positioned to derail any substantial disinvestment from fossil fuels, instead set to implement a big corporate greenwash bonanza. Harjeet Singh, can you talk about what is actually happening inside the COP and how you can derail them?
Well, you know, I'll go back to the same problem that is at its core of negotiation, where you don't talk about fossil fuel industry, where we don't talk about the interests of corporations and how they have been trying to manage these negotiations. You know, until this point, they were also funding the COP process itself. And after a lot of, advocacy efforts from civil society, they have been backed off, particularly for this COP. But that's not enough. As the comment clearly says, that they have increased their power, and now they are using those numbers of trillions of dollars just to say that they are on track. But in reality, they are getting a lot more power. And that's exactly the reason developing countries and civil society have been saying that we have to talk about public finance. You know, even that $100 billion, which is supposed to attract trillions, is not public finance. And if we rely on such private finance, where profit motive is at its core of their interest, then how are we going to achieve the kind of transition which should be seen as a public good? You know, we are talking about people who are already facing climate crisis. We need to talk about the interest of workers if we are going to move them, from fossil fuel industry to clean energy industries. So what is going to happen? How we are going to support them? Do we think this private capital is going to help them and take care of the interest of these workers and communities? Not at all. They're going to just make profits, and that's the real challenge that we have right now.
And Harjeet, could you talk more, explain the issue of climate finance and what's been happening? Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, just pledged £1 million to help developing countries deal with loss and damage. Do you expect other rich countries to follow suit and the significance of her having done so?
Well, Scotland indeed has broken the taboo of loss and damage finance. Now, when we talk about loss and damage finance, we mean helping people who are facing the climate crisis now, who are being battered by floods and storms, and they need to rebuild their lives, and countries need to rebuild their economies. There is no stream of finance on loss and damage under this UN system. And we have been fighting for it, I would say, for 30 years, because the first time it was Vanuatu in 1991 who brought up the issue of how are we going to help countries who are being affected or who are going to be affected by climate change. And here we are. There is no stream of funding, and the United States has been blocking it right from the beginning and not even allowing it to be on the agenda of even this particular COP. And due to our lobbying, and Scotland government came up and they realized that this is a massive gap, and that's how they have pledged £1 million, which is great. You know, the amount may not be that big, but it's a major breakthrough and puts many developed countries to shame that you should have done it. You know, people are suffering at 1.1 degree temperature rise. Millions of people are getting displaced and they're not getting any help. So this should definitely put pressure on other rich countries to follow suit. And that's exactly what we are doing.
Harjeet Singh, before we end, we want to address the issue of migration and its connection to climate. Kumi Naidoo, the former head of Greenpeace and Amnesty International, talks about walls as the climate wall. A new report from Transnational Institute finds some of the world's most polluting countries have spent over twice as much on border enforcement than on combating the climate crisis. The worst offenders, Canada, the U.S., Australia, and the U.K. Additionally, the world's largest fossil fuel companies employing the same companies that receive government contracts to militarize their borders. Harjit, your response.
Well, the reality is that people who are getting displaced because of climate change, that number is increasing. And when policymakers should be alarmed with those numbers and coming up with responses so that we can help these people, the surveillance industry, as you mentioned, Amy, has seen a business opportunity. And they are using it in a very divisive manner just to make money. Whereas these people who are being displaced, and majority of them stay in their own country. You know, a fraction of that population crosses borders, and a fraction of that population then crosses international borders. So in those circumstances, we first need to talk about providing support to people so that they do not have to cross borders. And crossing borders means they are living in a real desperate situation. And that's why they leave everything and cross borders and take so much of risk. So instead of, you know,
we
this particular crisis providing opportunity to the surveillance industry to make money, we all should be coming together and showing solidarity to these people who are getting displaced and support them so that they can rebuild their lives.
We want to thank you so much of Climate Action Network. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
Of a vehicle theft, but an alarming number of drivers are leaving themselves vulnerable. Keys and fobs are being left in unattended vehicles, making it easier for thieves to hop in and take off. This is especially true in winter months when owners leave their vehicles running to keep them warm. Don't make it easy for thieves. Lock your vehicle, set the alarm, and take all keys or fobs with you. Never leave a car unlocked and running. If you know something about a vehicle theft, call us at 1-800-TELL-NICB. A public service message from the National Insurance Crime Bureau.
I'm Ella Harp, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Tartan Inc. joins you in supporting WRCT. Tartan Inc. is a full-service copy print shop conveniently located in the university's Cajon Center on the Carnegie Mellon campus. Services provided by the Copy Center include black and white and color copies, single and double-sided copying, an assortment of colored and textured papers, including cover stock, specialty papers such as gloss paper, resume quality paper, as well as large format poster paper. They also offer binding and finishing options that include cutting, lamination, folding, padding, stapling, tape binding, thermal binding, collating, comb binding, and coil binding, as well as being an authorized ship and drop-off site for UPS shipping. For more info, visit their website at www.cmu.edu/tartaninc. or call 412-268-4828. If you are interested in underwriting for WRCT, please email pr@wrct.org for more info about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Counterspin provides a critical examination of the major stories every week and exposes what corporate media might have missed in their own coverage. Counterspin highlights censored stories and exposes biased and inaccurate coverage while examining the power of corporate influence and sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, Wednesdays, 10 to 10:30 a.m. right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, it's the Mockster from WRCT's own Friday night extravaganza, Viva La Mock, reminding you that you're listening to Whiskey Before Breakfast with my good friend, Mando Richard. But then again, unless you're a first-time listener, you probably already knew what you're listening to, right? Huh? Right? And if not, maybe, just maybe, you've had a little too much whiskey before breakfast, if you know what I mean.
Everybody ready? Mm-hmm.
Well, hello there, everybody, and welcome to episode 2143 of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania at WMCK.FM. I am Mando Richard, and for the next 2 hours or so, I've got a show that I know you will enjoy. We'll start off on the liquored up side of the family, like we always do, and we'll close down on the gospel side of the family, like we always do. And in between, we've got a wild ride that you will enjoy. Let's start things off with Billy Law. And he's got a new song about drinking and leaving voicemail. Here's Billy Law and voicemail right here on Whiskey Before Breakfast.
Ain't the beer, it's the whiskey. And even call you to me. I just want someone to whisper. Tell me I'll be alright.